The saloon had been practically emptied when everyone ran outside to see what the gunshot was about. Now they all went back inside to get a closer look at this man who had only today arrived in town and had already shot and killed one of their citizens.
I would like a whiskey, please.
The bartender, who had moved to the window to watch the action when all his customers left the saloon, served the whiskey without comment. A moment later, a man wearing a badge came in and, seeing Pritchard at the bar, walked over to him.
I'm Sheriff Nelson.
It's very good to meet you, Sheriff Nelson. I'm Abe Connor. Won't you join me for a drink, bartender?
No. Mr. Connor, you just killed a man.
Yes, I'm afraid I did. It was most unfortunate, but as I am sure that any of those who witnessed it will attest, I had no choice. I was forced into a kill-or-be-killed moment, despite repeated efforts on my part to defuse the situation.
Stranger's right, Sheriff. I seen everything. This here fella, he tried his damnedest to keep it from happening. He even apologized to the Rogers boy.
How about the rest of you? Did any of you see it?
Many of the patrons had witnessed the shooting. They all said that the gunfight had been forced by Teddy Rogers and that Abe Connor was innocent of any wrongdoing. Over the next several days, Pritchard began to make himself at home in Pecos. He sent a wreath of flowers to the funeral of Teddy Rogers and made a point of apologizing to Lucy. Pritchard's apparent contrition for what had happened to Teddy, his gentlemanly behavior, and his soft-spoken manner quickly won the respect of the townspeople. Within a couple of weeks after he arrived in town, he was having his dinner when Sheriff Nelson came into the restaurant. Pritchard saw the sheriff inquire at the counter, and he saw the clerk pointing toward him. What had happened? Had the sheriff gotten word from Kansas? Slowly, and without being observed, Pritchard pulled his pistol from his holster and held it under the table. The sheriff nodded at the clerk, then started toward Pritchard's table. Pritchard slowly pulled the hammer back and turned the pistol slightly so that it was aimed squarely at the sheriff.
Mr. Connor?
Yes?
I would like to talk to you. Would you mind if I joined you?
What would be the subject of our conversation? But please do have a seat.
Pritchard managed to slip his pistol back into its holster without its presence being noticed.
Well, I've been watching you, Mr. Connor, and I've had others watching you as well.
Huh?
Yes, I thought it best to see how the town was taking to you before I made the offer. I wanted to see if there was anyone holding the killing of Teddy Rogers against you. And since there doesn't seem to be, I feel I can make the offer without any reservations.
You are confusing me, Sheriff Nelson. What offer would that be?
I would like to appoint you to the position of Deputy Sheriff of Pecos County.
Why?
Well, sir, it's obvious that you can handle a gun. Nearly the entire town saw your encounter with young Teddy Rogers.
I'm not proud of that, Sheriff. The boy pushed me into it. It actually reached the point of my life or his. I tried to dissuade him, as witnesses will attest, and...
Please, Mr. Connor, there was absolutely nothing implied in that remark. I'm merely stating that fact as validation for extending the offer. I'm afraid the county can't pay much, but we can furnish you with a room in the back of the sheriff's office, and we have a contract with Kirby's Cafe to furnish you all of your meals. You're laughing, sir, but I am quite serious.
I am laughing, Sheriff, because I never saw myself as a peace officer. But, yes, I think I will accept your offer. Maybe my serving as a deputy sheriff will go a long way in mitigating the unfortunate circumstances of my arrival.
I'll say this for you, Connor. You have one hell of a way of talking. You're going to give the sheriff's office a lot of class. How about you coming over to the office after you finish your meal, and I'll swear you in.
I'll be there.
When Pritchard showed up at the sheriff's office a short while later, he saw several others there as well. Sheriff Nelson identified them as the mayor, the judge, and the city attorney. The judge administered the oath of office, then the others offered their congratulations. Smiling, Pritchard pinned on the star of his office. Then, after an introductory stroll around town during which he met the businessmen of the city, he stopped by the telegraph office to send a message to his brother in Shady Rest. To Dale Morgan, have accepted position as deputy sheriff in Pecos County, Texas. Stop. Will endeavor to do my best to keep the peace. Stop. Abe Connor. The telegram sent, Pritchard continued his introductory stroll through the town, opening doors for women, greeting the men, and being friendly with the children. Back in Shady Rest, Crowley, Fletcher, and Carter were playing cards at the Big Palace when a boy of about 16 wearing a Western Union cap came into the saloon.
Morgan? Mr. Dale Morgan? Is there somebody here named Dale Morgan? Morgan, I have a telegram for someone named Dale Morgan.
Hey, Mutt, that's you.
What's me?
That Western Union boy is calling for a Morgan. That's you, don't you remember?
Oh, yeah.
Crowley looked toward the door just as the delivery boy was about to leave.
Wait a minute, boy, I'm Morgan.
The telegraph delivery boy stopped and turned back.
You got any proof of that, mister? I can't give out telegrams to just anyone.
These two men know me, they'll tell you.
Yeah, he's Morgan.
The boy came over to hand the piece of paper to Crowley, then he stood by the table for a moment.
What are you standing there for?
Most of the time when I deliver a telegram, why, the person that gets it gives me a tip.
A what?
A tip. Don't you know what a tip is?
No, what is it?
It means you give me money for delivering the telegram to you.
What for? I didn't ask for the telegram.
Well, it's just what folks do.
Well, did whoever send this telegram to me pay for it?
Well, yes, sir. Of course they did. It would not have been sent otherwise.
Then go away. You got your money.
The boy glared at Crowley for a moment, then left.
Who sent you a telegram?
I don't reckon I'm gonna know that till I open it.
Opening the telegram, Crowley read it.
Ha! I'll be damned!
What is it?
Crowley showed the telegram to the other two.
My brother's a lawman! Can you beat that?
About a week after leaving Smoke's place, Matt approached a little town around midday. Stopping on a ridge, he looked down at the town. Matt was here simply because he had no particular place to be, other than the place he was. That meant he could and should go south in the winter and north in the summer. So why was he here in Texas in the summer when he could have been in Montana? He thought of the answer. He was here because south was the way his horse had been headed when he left the last town. Slapping his legs against the side of his horse, he headed the animal down the long slope of the ridge, wondering what town this was. A small sign just on the edge of town answered the question for him. Sherwood, population 103, still growing. The weathered board and faded letters of the sign indicated that it had been there for some time. Matt doubted that there were 103 residents in the town today. False-fronted shanties lined each side of the street, straggling along for no more than 50 yards. Then, just as abruptly as the town started, it quit, and the prairie began again. The buildings were weathered and leaning, and the painted signs on the front of the edifices were worn and hard to read. An empty wagon, its wood baked white in the sun, was backed up to the general store, and the attached team of mules stood unmoving in front of it. Matt dismounted in front of a saloon called the Watering Hole and went inside. Shadows made the saloon seem cooler, but that was illusory. It was nearly as hot inside as out, and without the benefit of a breath of air, it was even more stifling. The customers were sweating in their drinks and wiping their faces with bandanas. As always, when he entered a strange saloon, Matt checked the place out. To one unfamiliar with what he was doing, Matt's glance appeared to be little more than idle curiosity. But it was a studied surveillance that he'd learned long ago from his mentor Smoke Jensen, and he could hear Smoke's voice now. As far as Matt could determine, there were only workers and cowboys here, all but two of them unarmed. The two who were armed were young men, and Matt would bet that they had never used them for anything but target practice, and probably not very successfully at that. The bartender stood behind the bar. In front of him were two glasses in which some whiskey was remaining, and he poured the whiskey back into a bottle, corked it, and put the bottle on the shelf behind the bar. He wiped the glasses out with his stained apron, then set them among the unused glasses. Seeing Matt step up to the bar, the bartender moved down toward him.
Whiskey.
The barman reached for the bottle he had just poured the whiskey back into, but Matt pointed to an unopened bottle.
That one.
Mister, I ain't gonna open a new bottle just for you.
Matt saw that there was a beer barrel sitting on a pair of sawhorses behind the bar.
All right, I'll have a beer.
Shrugging, the saloon keeper took down a mug and started toward the beer spigot.
Wait a minute. Let me check that mug.
You're kind of particular, ain't you?
The bartender handed the mug to Matt. Matt looked at it, then handed it back to him.
All right.
The bartender drew the mug of beer, then set it in front of Matt.
Ain't seen you before. Just come into town, did you?
I'm not in town. I'm just passing through. Thought I'd have a couple of drinks, eat some food that isn't trail cooked, then be on my way.
What brings you to this neck of the woods?
Nothing in particular.
I don't think you're gonna like it here, mister. I think you're gonna find that things here is just a little too quick for your kind. You'd best just keep on moving.
Paying no attention to the comment, Matt lifted the beer to his lips. Taking a swallow, he wiped the foam from his mouth with the back of his hand.
Is there a place to eat in this town?
There's Kate's place just down the street. Nothing fancy, but the food is good.
Good is good.
Hey, mister, are you deaf? I said you best just be moving on.
Matt turned to look at him for the first time. He was a big man, well over 6 feet tall, with a dark, bushy beard. Matt figured that he weighed at least 250 pounds.
Mister, you seem to have something stuck in your craw. What would that be?
I don't like saddle bums.
Waters, you got no call to ride one of my customers like that. He ain't done nothing but buy a beer, which he paid for.
I know his kind. Seen him before, back when I was working as a bum chaser for the T&P. Bumming rides on cars, they was. Hell, I've lost count of the number of them I've thrown off the cars between Shreveport and El Paso.
Matt picked up his beer and held it toward Waters.
Here's to you, Mr. Waters, for keeping the railroad safe.
I don't drink with no count bums like you.
I'm not sure I understand. Is it that you don't drink with any no-count bums, or is it that you don't drink with no-count bums like me?
Waters, realizing that the others in the bar were laughing at him, pointed at Matt.
I don't like you, mister. I don't like you at all.
Oh, I guess that means you won't be asking me to the barn dance. I was so looking forward to it.
Waters, you was saying things here's a little too quick for this fella. Looks to me like he's a little too quick for you.
Waters, his face flushed red with anger and embarrassment, charged toward Matt. With Waters knocked out on the floor, Matt put his pistol back in his holster, then picked up his beer.
Does Mr. Waters greet all your customers that way?
To tell you the truth, mister, we don't get that many visitors in Sherwood. But Waters pretty much has the whole town buffaloed. I reckon he figured he needed to take you down just to show everyone else that he was still the top rooster.
Finishing his beer, Matt put the glass down and slapped another nickel on the bar beside it.
I'll have another.
No, sir.
The bartender pushed the coin back. Matt gave the bartender a questioning look.
This one's on me.
Half an hour later, after having a meal at Kate's place, Matt rode on. In order to satisfy the demands of the mayor's wife, Annabelle O'Callaghan took an inventory of all the dressmaking fabric she had on hand and realized that it was going to be necessary to go to Van Horn to buy new material. She didn't mind making the trip. She needed to restock some items anyway, so she would let the dress she was making for Mrs. Todd be both the excuse and the financial basis of the trip. Van Horn wasn't much larger than Shady Rest, but it was located on the Texas and Pacific Railroad, and because of that, it acted as a distribution point for goods and supplies that came in by rail from all over the country. Shady Rest was connected to Van Horn, indeed to the outside world, by the Van Horn and Shady Rest stagecoach line. There was only one coach, and it made a run to Van Horn on one day, then returned the next day. Annabelle, as she had done many times before, put up a sign in the door of her shop.
Elite shop closed for the day. Gone to Van Horn for supplies, will reopen in 2 days.
George Tobin operated the stagecoach line and handled the ticket sales and all the bookwork. He had 4 employees, 2 drivers and 2 shotgun guards. They alternated the trips, and on the day they worked on the trip, they maintained the livestock and equipment at the Home Depot. When Annabelle approached the depot, she saw that the team was being connected. Dusty Reasoner was standing near the rear of the coach with one hand up on the boot.
Good morning, Miss O'Callaghan. Are you taking a trip with us today?
Yes, I have to buy some material. Are you our driver?
Yes, ma'am. I'm driving. Jim Richards will be riding shotgun. I'll try and give you folks a real smooth trip today.
Good. I'll hold you to that.
That afternoon, Annabelle was standing at the fabric table looking at the bolts of cloth there on display.
Hello, Annabelle. It's good to see you again. What brings you this time?
Hello, Glenda. I'm to make a new dress for the mayor's wife, and I want it to be something special.
Well, just got in some new cotton sateen that is quite lovely.
Over the next several minutes, Glenda helped Annabelle pick out 6 bolts of material from white cotton to green silk to purple wool.
Do you want your purchases shipped to you, Annabelle?
No, thank you. I'll be going back on tomorrow's stagecoach. Could you have them taken to the depot so they can be loaded onto the coach?
Of course.
The railroad bar smelled of cheap whiskey, stale beer, and sour tobacco. There was a long bar on the left with dirty towels hanging on hooks about every 5 feet along its front. A large mirror was behind the bar, but like everything else about the saloon, it was so dirty that Braxton could scarcely see any images in it, and what he could see was distorted by imperfections in the glass. Over against the back wall, near the foot of the stairs, a cigar-scarred, beer-stained upright piano was sitting, not being used. At a table next to the piano, Braxton Barlow saw his 2 older brothers, Ben and Bert. It was Ben who had come up with the idea of holding up a stagecoach.
It's a lot easier than robbing a bank. Once you rob a bank, you still gotta get away, and that means riding right down the middle of the street so that damn near everyone in town can take a shot at you. But whenever you hold up a stagecoach, you're already out in the country. And all you gotta do after you get the money is just ride off.
Ben was the oldest of the 3 Barlow brothers. Bert was in the middle, and Brax was the youngest. When Ben suggested they hold up the stagecoach to Shady Rest, it wasn't hard to talk his 2 brothers into going along with it.
How much money will a stagecoach be carrying?
I don't know, but they always carry some money, delivering it back and forth between banks and such. And if nothing else, the passengers will be carrying some money. It'll be as easy as taking candy off of a baby.
You know what I'm gonna do when I get the money?
What?
I'm gonna go down to Mexico, and I'm gonna buy me the bestest looking whore I can find. No, I'm gonna make it the 2 bestest looking whores I can find. One for the daytime, and one for the night. I'm gonna get me some whiskey.
Tequila.
What?
If you're down in Mexico, you won't be getting no whiskey. You'll be getting tequila.
All right, tequila, what do I care? I'm gonna get tequila, and then I ain't gonna do nothing but lay with them whores and drink that tequila till the money runs out.
What you should do is get a pretty daytime whore and an ugly nighttime whore. The ugly whores don't cost as much.
What do I want an ugly whore for? If I got the money, I want a pretty whore.
Hell, at nighttime, ugly's as good as pretty. You can't see them in the dark anyway.
Yeah, I guess so. When are we going to hold up the stagecoach?
Tomorrow morning. The coach will leave at about 8, so I figure if we leave around 6 in the morning, we'll be in place to waylay it when it comes by.
Yeah, good idea.
6 o'clock? That's awful early, ain't it?
I want plenty of time to find the right place.
I agree with Ben. 6 o'clock ain't too early to make sure the job gets done right.
Good. So you boys be ready to go when I call for you in the morning.
Back in Pecos, Sheriff Nelson entered his office.
Abe, we got a new batch of wanted posters in yesterday afternoon, and I'd like you to take care of them.
Take care of them in what respect?
Well, like we might get a poster that says something like, John Calhoun is wanted. Only John Calhoun has already been caught, or killed. So if that's the case, you just tear up the poster and throw it away.
How will I know the status of the subjects?
What?
How will I know if John Calhoun has been killed or captured?
Oh, that's easy. Along with the posters, there will also be an update on the status of previous posters. If you get a notice that a poster is being recalled, you can take it down. I also have a list in my desk drawer of previous withdrawals, so check them all against that list, just in case you get a duplicate. The posters that are good, you can put up on the wall here. Then, later, go down to put them at the post office.
All right. That doesn't sound too difficult.
I know this might be boring work for you, being as how smart you are and all, but it's generally the job that the junior deputy does, and since you've been a deputy for the shortest time, it's going to be your job.
I'll be glad to do it, Sheriff, and I shall do so without complaint.
You're a good man. I'm going to take a stroll around town. I'll be back in a while.
Take your time, Sheriff. I'll be here when you get back.
The third and fourth wanted posters were for Mutt and Pritchard Crowley, offering rewards of $5,000 for each of them. There were also dodgers out for Bill Carter, Lenny Fletcher, Dax Williams, and Titus Carmichael, offering $1,500. That surprised him, because he didn't know they'd even been identified. Pritchard smiled as he tore the flyers into small pieces. This was exactly why he'd taken the job. It took him about 45 minutes to go through all the posters and to make the updates.
Hey, Sheriff.
Pritchard, who was drinking coffee, stepped back into the cell area. The prisoner who had called had been brought in the night before for public drunkenness, having been found passed out on the street. He was sitting up on the edge of the bunk, and he ran his hands through a shock of unruly hair.
Something I can do for you?
You are the new deputy, ain't you?
I am.
I could use a cup of coffee. You'll find my cup in the bottom right-hand drawer of the sheriff's desk. I take it black.
You have your own cup here? You must be a regular.
I expect to be issued a deputy's badge any day now.
Pritchard went to the sheriff's desk, opened the drawer, and found the prisoner's cup. Painted on the side of the cup was C.E. Blanton, attorney.
So you are a lawyer.
Pritchard handed Blanton the cup.
When I'm sober.
As a lawyer and an educated man, Mr. Blanton, I'm sure you realize that whiskey is the devil's brew. It defies reason, creates misery, dethrones men from the pinnacles of righteousness, and casts them into the bottomless pit of degradation, shame, and despair.
So say you, sir. But I see it as the oil of conversation, the philosophic wine, the elixir of life, the ale that is consumed when good fellows get together, that puts a song in their hearts and the warm glow of contentment in their eyes.
Pritchard turned and saw that Sheriff Nelson had just come in.
Both of you are so full of bullshit, you're a perfect match for each other.
The next morning, Dusty Reasoner, the driver, and Jim Richards, the shotgun guard, were standing alongside the coach as four passengers for Shady Rest came out of the stage depot to board. Dusty, in his late 60s, was the older of the two men. His hair and beard were gray, and he still walked with a limp from a wound he had sustained at Shiloh. Jim was in his early 40s and bald, though as he was seldom seen without a hat, only those who knew him well were aware of the fact. He had just rolled himself a cigarette and was smoking as the passengers approached the stagecoach.
Good morning, Miss O'Callaghan. Going back with us, I see. I hope you had a good visit to Van Horn.
Good morning, Mr. Reasoner. Yes, my visit was quite productive.
She climbed into the coach. The second passenger was Gerald Hawkins, the owner of the Texas Star in Shady Rest. Hawkins was 5'7" tall and weighed just over 150 pounds, which was about average for the cavalryman he had once been. His black hair was slicked down and parted in the middle. He had a closely trimmed mustache, and he wore a jacket, a vest, and a string tie.
Dusty, you old horse thief. See if you can avoid hitting every pothole between here and Shady Rest.
Well, I plan to find new potholes that ain't never been hit yet, just for you.
The third passenger was Elwood Crocker. Crocker owned a small ranch just outside of town, and he dressed the part in denim trousers and a white shirt.
Miss O'Callaghan, you're going back to Shady Rest? Heck, I was hoping you were planning on moving to Van Horn. If you was to do so, why, that sure would save me a lot of money.
Now, Mr. Crocker, are you going to tell me you don't think Julia is just beautiful in the gowns I make for her?
No, ma'am, I can't say that. So I reckon you've got me there. I always did think Julia was a pretty thing, but I have to admit that some of those dresses you make for her make her that much prettier.
Oh, just some of them?
Well, all of them.
The fourth passenger was Percy McCall, a Notions drummer who called frequently upon Annabelle. Like Hawkins, McCall wore a suit in keeping with his profession, And like Hawkins, McCall was a relatively small man, though he didn't have the wiry strength and toughness of Hawkins.
Why, Mr. McCall, you could show me your wares while we are in the coach, and you wouldn't even have to call on me at my store.
No, ma'am, I want to call on you at your store. If we're there, you are likely to think of something you need that you will forget if we do business in the coach.
There you go, Miss O'Callaghan. You aren't the only one with a sales pitch, are you?
You folks all settled in down there?
We're all ready, Dusty. Let's get this show on the road.
All right. Yeah!
They left Van Horn at 8 o'clock in the morning for what would be a six-hour journey, and soon Annabelle began passing the time by making sketches of the dresses she intended to make.
I don't know how you can draw like that with all the bouncing around we're doing.
It's easy enough. I just draw when we're not bouncing.
Well, please tell me you aren't drawing up more dresses to sell to my wife.
Oh, not at all. These are designs for Mrs. Trout.
Ha! Huh, good for you. The more money that pompous ass of a mayor spends, the better I like it.
I like it, too. I especially like it when he spends the money with me.
It had been 2 weeks now since Matt Jensen had left Sherwood, the last town he had visited, and he was tired. It wasn't just a tiredness from several weeks of being on the road. It was a tired-to-the-bone weariness from a life lived always on the move. And even though it was a life that he chose, there were times, like this, when he could almost envy Smoke Jensen with his ranch, wife, house, and bed to sleep in at night. Right now, he especially envied him the bed. Matt stood in the stirrups just to give his butt a break. Then, seeing a clear, swiftly running stream, he headed toward it and stopped to let his horse Spirit have a drink while he filled his canteen. The water tasted good, but a beer would have been better. Texas was not only a big state, it was a state with a lot of nothing in it, with vast distances between the towns, especially in the wide open spaces of West Texas. If he would, somehow, come across a town in this godforsaken wilderness, the first thing he would do, even before replenishing his possibles, would be to have a beer.
Yeah, Spirit, what do you think of that? I say a cool beer, hot meal, hot bath, and a real bed. But don't worry, I'll be taking care of you as well. I'll get you your own stall, some oats, and I wouldn't doubt but there might be a young filly there to turn your eye. But don't be taken in by her sweet talk. You have to be very careful of that.
Matt was alone so much that he often talked to his horse just to hear a human voice, even if it was his own. And he figured that talking to Spirit was better than talking to himself. Refreshed, Matt remounted, then continued his ride. Not more than a mile from Matt at that very moment, the Shady Rest stagecoach was continuing its run from Van Horn to Shady Rest. The three Barlow brothers, Ben, Bert, and Brax, were waiting in a little thicket of trees alongside the road where the coach would pass.
How much longer?
I don't know. 15 minutes, half an hour, maybe?
I wish it would come on. It's just waiting around for it's just making me nervous.
There ain't no call for you to be getting nervous. I told you, there ain't nothing to it. When the coach gets close, we'll just jump out in front of it and stop them.
What if they don't stop?
Then we'll shoot them.
I gotta take a piss.
Well, if you're gonna do it now and do it fast, because I can see the stagecoach coming.
Where?
Look down that way.
Looking south, Bert saw a cloud of dust far down the road.
All right.
Less than a minute later, emerging from the dust, he could see the coach itself.
Brax, Bert, you boys ready?
Oh, yeah.
Brax buttoned his trousers.
I'm ready.
When it gets close enough, we'll jump out in front of it.
Ben pulled a hood down over his head and positioned it so the two holes lined up with his eyes. Brax and Bert did the same thing. Dusty Reasoner and Jim Richards were upon the box seat of the stage. Dusty was handling the ribbons, but Jim was just sitting there, his shotgun propped up against the corner of the curved footrest in front of them.
You know, I can't quite get a handle on Miss O'Callaghan.
What do you mean?
Well, I mean, how come she ain't married? She's old enough and she's sure pretty enough.
Thinking of asking her, are you, Jim?
Who, me? Heck no. That little old filly is way too smart for me. I mean, the way she runs that business and all.
Well, you just answered your own question. The reason she ain't married is because most likely she's smarter than just about any man in town. And most men don't like being married to a woman that's smarter than they are.
Yeah, I reckon you're right. I once knowed a woman a lot smarter than me.
A woman smarter than you?
Yeah.
I don't even have to ask who it was.
What do you mean?
Well, you figure it out.
What the hell, Dusty? Looky there!
Just ahead of the coach, three mounted and masked men suddenly rode out into the road in front of them. All three were holding pistols, and the pistols were aimed at the coach. One of the mounted men held out his free hand.
Stop the coach!
Whoa!
Damn!
Jim raised his shotgun. Jim felt a hammer blow to his shoulder. The impact of the bullet caused him to drop his shotgun.
Just take it easy. We don't want to give him any more reason to shoot.
Don't try anything like that again.
What do you want?
What do you think I want? I want you to throw your money box down.
Are you crazy, mister? I don't know what you think we're carrying, but we ain't got no money box. This here is the Van Horn and Shady Rest stage. We don't hardly ever carry no money. The onlyest thing we're carrying now is a pouch of letters.
All right, throw the pouch down.
Yeah, I'll throw the pouch down if you say so, but do you really want to do that? You start messing with the mail and it becomes a federal offense. And like as not, there ain't going to be nothing in there but just personal letters anyhow.
All right, don't throw the mail pouch down. We'll just take whatever money your passengers have on them.
One of the men dismounted and approached the coach, holding a pistol at the ready.
You folks inside there, come on out now. Climb down. I said climb down out of there, and I ain't asking again. You better do what I told you, or else the next time I shoot, I'll start shooting right into the coach.
The door opened and Hawkins was the first one out. He turned back toward the door.
What are you doing?
One of the passengers is a lady. I'm helping her down.
Yeah? We'll be quick about it.
From the moment Matt heard the gunshots, he urged Spirit into a gallop, racing to the sound. Cresting her eyes, he saw a stagecoach stopped on the road. It didn't take but one quick observation to determine what was going on. The passengers were outside the coach, three men and a woman, and all of them were holding their hands in the air. The driver and shotgun guard were still upon the box, but the shotgun guard was holding his hand over a shoulder wound. There were three masked men, two of them were mounted, while the third was dismounted and facing the passengers. All three of the men were holding guns. Matt snaked his rifle from the saddle sheet, dismounted, and aimed at the one who was on the ground.
You men, throw down your guns.
What the hell?
Two of the armed men turned the guns toward Matt. One of the bullets took Matt's hat off. Matt returned fire and the robber on the ground went down. One of the two mounted robbers, the one who had fired at him the first time, took aim again. But already Matt was on the move and the shot missed. Matt didn't miss. The robber fell from his saddle. The third would-be robber, who had not fired at all, put spurs to his horse and galloped off. The two other horses, their saddles now empty, galloped off without him. Matt put his rifle away, remounted, then urged Spirit into a brisk trot to close the distance between the top of the hill and the coach.
Mister, I don't know who you are, but am I glad to see you. Whew! You just saved our bacon.
Looking up toward the box, Matt saw the shotgun guard holding his hand over the wound in his shoulder. He could see that the man's shirt sleeve was soaked with blood.
How badly are you hurt?
Man, if you want to know how bad it hurts like hell. But the bullet hit me in the shoulder, so I don't reckon it hit any of my vitals.
You folks, you just climb back in and we'll get started into town.
Before you get started, we better see to the guard's wound. No sense in letting him bleed to death.
I've got some cloth in the boot you could use as a bandage.
The pretty redhead pulled her luggage from the boot of the coach and a swath of cotton was removed. Climbing up onto the stage, Matt made a compression bandage which he put over the wound. Then he held it in place by looping the guard's belt around it.
Now, Jim, once we get into town, don't you go hopping down without no thought whatever. Well, with no belt on, why, you're liable to drop your pants right there in front of the whole town.
Oh!
As Matt was tending to the shotgun guard, Crocker, Hawkins, and McCall pulled the hoods off the two dead, would-be stagecoach robbers.
Dusty,
None of us know these galoots. Have you ever seen either of them?
No, can't say as I have.
Well, there it is. I can't positively say I've never seen either of them. I get so many people coming through that saloon that after a while they all start looking alike to me. But if I have seen them before, I sure don't remember them.
All right, this should hold them until we get to a doctor. Where are you headed?
To Shady Rest. It's about 10 more miles. Tell the truth, mister, with Jim shot up like he is, I'd appreciate it if he would ride along with us.
I'm not going to leave you.
Thanks. It'll be a comfort having you along.
Do they have a place where I can get a cold beer in Shady Rest? Maybe a place to get a hot meal and rent a room?
Mister, my name is Gerald Hawkins, and I own the Texas Star Saloon. I don't know how much you can drink, but I personally guarantee you that for the rest of this day, you can drink free at my place. And as far as the meal and room is concerned, why, there's places in town that can accommodate you.
I'm much obliged, Mr. Hawkins.
No, sir, we are the ones who are obliged.
All right, folks, if you'll all get back in the coach, we'll be on our way.
What about these two? We can't just leave them lying here, can we?
Why not? They won't mind.
Well, just don't seem right.
Don't worry about it. Ponder will send someone out after him. The county will give him $30 apiece to bury him. That's twice what the town pays him. Now, you folks, climb on back in. I need to get Jim here to a doctor and get you folks home.
Brax Barlow had ridden off at a gallop as soon as the shooting started. Then, after waiting about half an hour, he rode back to take a look around. The coach was gone, but his two brothers were still lying there, dead in the road.
Sons of bitches didn't even bother to pick them up.
For a moment, he wondered what should be done about them. Should he bury them? Should he try to take them somewhere? Where would he take them? And how would he explain the bullet wounds?
Well, it's your own damn fault. What'd you start shooting for? I'm not taking candy from a baby, he said. Well, we're no such thing. Now you're lying here dead.
Brax had no idea who the son of a bitch was that killed him, but he was pretty sure he could find out if he went on into Shady Rest. And because he had been wearing a mask and had never been to Shady Rest before, he was sure that he could go without fear of being recognized.
All right, Ben. Bert, this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to find out who the son of a bitch is who done this to you. When I find him, I'm going to kill him. That's the least I can do for you. Oh, and Bert, seeing as you ain't going to be using them no more, I'm aiming to take your boots. That is, if it's all the same to you.
When Mutt Crowley awakened that morning, he looked over at the woman who was lying in bed with him. The cover was turned down to her waist, and he could see the blue veins of her bulbous breasts. She had a disfigured scar on her cheek from an altercation with a drunken customer. Mutt wasn't exactly sure as to how he had wound up with this woman. He didn't know whether he had been too drunk or too horny when he came up to her room last night, but in either case, he was having a severe case of buyer's remorse this morning. Mutt had a terrible need to urinate, and he got out of bed and looked around for the chamber pot.
Damn, where the hell is it?
After taking care of his business, Mutt got dressed and went downstairs into the saloon to see if he could find Carter and Fletcher. He saw them sitting at one of the tables drinking beer and eating boiled eggs and pickled pig's feet for breakfast. The saloon kept boiled eggs and pickled pig's feet in big jars sitting on the bar. Mutt ordered a beer, then stuck his hand down into the vinegar to fish out a couple of the pig's feet. He joined Carter and Fletcher at the table, then began chewing through the tough skin.
I seen you got yourself a woman last night. How'd she look this morning?
What'd you mean, how she look?
Well, last night you was carrying on something fierce about how pretty she was.
I was?
Yeah, he was, wasn't he, Carter?
Yep, you said she's one of the prettiest whores you'd ever seen.
Damn, how drunk was I?
You were so damn drunk that you wouldn't listen to either one of us. We tried to tell you that she was so ugly she'd make a train take 5 miles of dirt road, but you told us to mind our own business.
Yeah, well, that might be a pretty good idea right now, too. Damn, when I had money, I had only the best-looking whores money could buy. Nothing like that ugly old hag I woke up with this morning. I tell you what, I'm going to find me a poker game today, and I'm going to get me some money back. I don't like living without money.
Yeah, well, truth to tell, I done seen all the whores that's working the Pig Palace, the Crooked Branch, the Ace High, even over at Abby's place. And they ain't any one of them as much better looking than the one you wound up with. And yours wasn't no worse than the ones that me or Carter had. There ain't a whore in this whole town who could look into a mirror without breaking it. And that's a fact.
They say there's some good whores over at Susie's Dream House, and some pretty good-looking women over at the Texas Star, too.
Yeah, well, the ones at the Dream House want too much money, and the women at the Texas Star ain't whores. Besides which, none of them will have anything to do with me, even if I do have money. Now, I don't know what makes them so damn snooty. Hell, they ain't exactly what you call high society.
You're going to have to go over there if you want to get into a card game. That is a card game where you can make a little money, because the only games over here, even across the street in the gambling house, are penny-ante games. The real money game is over at the Texas Star.
Yeah, that's what I heard, too. They got a game going on there near about the old time. They say there's a gambling man there who's just real good.
What do you mean, real good?
I mean he makes his living playing cards. And you can't make a living playing cards unless you win a lot more than you lose.
Yeah? Well, he ain't played me yet, has he?
Oh, you're that good, are you?
When I was inside, I made friends with a professional gambler. And he taught me some tricks.
You try any tricks, you're liable to get yourself shot.
I ain't talking about cheating tricks. I'm talking about smart playing tricks. But one thing is, you gotta have enough money to be able to play without running scared all the time. And most all my money's gone now. But I tell you what, you two boys loan me $50 apiece.
What? Damn, I ain't got but just a little over $100 now.
And I don't even have $100.
You wouldn't either one of you have that money if it wasn't for me and my brother. You loan me $50 each, I'll also put up $50, and that way I have enough to play with, and we'll split my winnings three ways.
You're pretty sure you're going to win, huh?
I'm damn sure I'm going to win.
All right. Come on, Lenny, let's pony up. Who knows, maybe he'll win pretty big. Like to have a little spending money again.
The professional card player who was practicing his profession at the Texas Star was Emerson Culpepper. Culpepper was the quintessential Southern gentleman who was always well turned out, not only in the clothes he wore, but in his personal hygiene, the way he kept his hair and mustache neatly trimmed. Culpepper never cheated. His skill was such that cheating wasn't necessary. However, his success in cards often brought about charges of cheating, and he found it necessary from time to time to relocate from one place to another before he completely wore out his welcome. That was how he had arrived in Shady Rest 6 weeks earlier and had, with the permission of Gerald Hawkins, set up his operation in the Texas Star. Culpepper secured Hawkins' permission by offering him 10% of the table. Everyone who played cards with him was made aware that when they cashed in their chips, the house would keep 10%. And there were enough repeat players who had seen that the chips set aside did indeed go to the house that anyone who suggested that Hawkins was keeping the money for himself was quickly disabused of their mistaken notion. It had been a relatively slow morning. Indeed, at the moment, there were only two other players in the game when Mutt Crowley stepped up to his table.
I want to play some poker.
We have an open seat.
Crowley sat down and took out a stack of bills and put them on the table in front.
What's your name?
Morgan. Dale Morgan.
Mr. Morgan, you may notice that there is no cash on the table. We play with chips. You can get them from the bartender.
All right. Keep this seat open.
Crowley went over to the bar to buy some poker chips. When he returned, he put $150 worth of chips out on the table in front of him. Nobody else was showing more than $40.
Are you planning on buying the pots?
What if I am?
Well, I would recommend that you don't try to do that. You can't buy what the cards don't win.
Let's quit the gabbing and get on with the game.
Very well. Gentlemen, new player, new deck.
Culpepper picked up a box, broke the seal, then dumped the cards onto the table. They were clean, stiff, and shining. He pulled out the joker, then began shuffling the deck. His hands moved swiftly, folding the cards in and out until it felt right. He shoved the deck across the table.
You are the newest player. Would you like to cut?
Crowley cut the deck, then pushed them back.
The game is five-card stud.
Fine.
Crowley won $5 on the first hand, and within a few hands was ahead by a little over $20. He smiled broadly as he raked in his last winning hand. When Culpepper dealt the next hand, Crowley opened the bet with $25.
Why don't we play for some real money?
As the game went on in the Texas Star Saloon, Matt Jensen, riding ahead of the stagecoach, got his first glimpse of Shady Rest. Located in the shadow of El Capitan Mountain, the little town rose in front of him, at first barely distinguishable from among the hillocks and clumps of sagebrush. As he got closer, though, he could make out the town, a row of false-fronted buildings on either side of a north and south running street. The tallest structure was the church steeple at the far end of the street. As soon as they passed by the sign welcoming them to Shady Rest, Dusty, the stagecoach driver, whipped the team into a trot so that the coach rolled rapidly down the street, a rooster tail of dust billowing up behind the two oversized rear wheels.
We was held up! We was held up! Jim's been shot! Get the doc! Jim's been shot!
The stagecoach office stood right in the middle of town on the west side of the street. There, the driver stopped the coach. A considerable amount of people were gathered in front of the stage depot when they arrived.
Hey, couple of you fellas, help me get Jim down.
Two of the younger men climbed up onto the coach to begin taking the guard down.
Come on, Jim. Oh, it's all right.
God, Brad, take it easy with him.
Sorry.
Man.
Well, how much money did they get, Dusty?
Well, that's the beauty of it. They didn't get nothing at all. Fact is, there's two of them needing Ponder services right now. Seeing as they are lying dead out in the road about 10 miles back.
Well, I thought you said you was robbed.
There were three men who attempted to rob us.
Annabelle looked over toward Matt, who was still sitting his saddle.
But this brave gentleman broke it up.
By now, two more men came up to join the others. Both men were wearing stars, and one was much older than the other.
Who was it, Dusty? Do you know?
I don't have any idea at all, Marshal. Even when we took the masks off the two that was killed, there didn't none of us recognize them. So we just skedaddled on out of there on account of Jim here being shot like he was.
How bad is Jim hurt?
I ain't dead yet. Y'all quit talking about me like I'm done gone.
I don't know what made him decide to rob us in the first place. Hell, we wasn't carrying no money at all, except in maybe what the passengers might have had.
Did Jim shoot the robbers?
No, it was that fella, right there.
Dusty pointed to Matt. By now, Matt had dismounted and was tying Spirit off at the hitching rail. As he did so, the younger of the two star packers, the one who had been talking to Dusty, came over to talk to Matt.
My name is Pruitt. Devery Pruitt. I'm the marshal here.
Matt was a little surprised that it was the younger of the two men who was the marshal. The older man stood back, showing a degree of nonchalance as he leaned against one of the supporting posts of the front overhang.
The driver says you killed two of the robbers.
Yes.
You mind giving your name?
It's Jensen. Matt Jensen.
Jensen? Did that fella say his name is Jensen? Damn! What's he doing this far south?
Marsha Pruitt turned toward the man who had spoken.
Do you know this man?
I don't know him, but I sure know of him. I can't believe you ain't never heard of a marshal. Why, folks say he's about the best with a gun there is.
Is that so? Would you be what they call a gunfighter, Mr. Jensen?
I guess that all depend upon your definition of a gunfighter. I don't sell my guns, and I've never shot a man who wasn't trying to shoot me.
The two men you encountered today, did they shoot first?
They did.
This gentleman is telling you the truth, Marshal. Mr. Jensen got the drop on the robbers, and he even offered them the opportunity to give up, but they turned their weapons on him instead, and before Mr. Jensen came to our rescue, the three robbers were getting very threatening. I fear that if they had not been satisfied with what they got, they may well have taken it out on us. I don't mind telling you, I, for one, was very glad to see Mr. Jensen come along, arriving like the U.S. Cavalry, you might say.
Well, Jensen, I suppose it is good that you came along when you did. Will you be in town for a while? I mean, in case I have any questions later.
I plan to be in town for a day or two, or at least until I'm able to build up a supply of possibles. But for now, as soon as I take care of my horse, I plan to get a drink, a bath, a hotel room, and something to eat, in that order.
Well, Mr. Jensen, you don't have to worry none about your horse. I mean, in as far as boarding him is concerned, why, you can leave your horse with the coach horses. We'll take good care of him. Fresh hay, his own stall, and there won't be no charge at all. I'm sure once Mr. Tobin hears what you've done for his stagecoach company, why, he'll be more than glad to take care of your horse.
I know that Spirit is as tired as I am, so if you would, Dusty, give him some oats tonight. I'll be glad to pay for it.
Oats he'll have, and anything else he wants. And that won't cost you nothing neither. Like I said, the stagecoach company will be more than happy to pick up the tab.
That's very nice of you.
Well, that's the least we can do, seeing as what you've done for us.
Matt saw Jim, the shotgun guard, sitting on the porch of the stage depot, leaning back against the front wall. Someone, Matt assumed it was the doctor, was tending him. Matt walked over to him.
How you feeling, Jim?
Oh, tolerable, I reckon. And I thank you for patching me up like you done.
Are you the one that put the bandage on Mr. Richards?
Yes.
Well, young man, you probably saved his life by keeping him from bleeding to death. And do you have medical training?
Not exactly.
What do you mean?
I learned doctoring from a man named Smoke Jensen, and he learned it from an old mountain man called Preacher.
Well, you have my congratulations, sir, on a job well done.
And you have my thanks.
My pleasure.
Mr. Jensen.
Hawkins walked over to the depot porch to join Matt, the doctor, and the wounded stagecoach driver.
You still want that beer?
Oh, yes, I absolutely want that beer.
Then come with me. I'll show you some of the town as we walk down to my place.
All right.
Mr. Jensen.
Matt looked over toward the pretty redhead who had been the only female passenger on the stage.
Yes, ma'am.
Mr. Jensen, my name is Annabel O'Callaghan, and if you will allow me, I would be delighted to buy dinner for you this evening. I feel that would be the least I can do for you after what you did for us.
Why, Miss O'Callaghan, I would love to have dinner with you, but I wouldn't feel right having the woman pay for it.
Nonsense. I insist upon it. Shall I see you this evening?
Yes, ma'am. And you have my appreciation for your generous offer.
You are very welcome. But don't you dare say ma'am to me again. I'm not your school teacher.
Matt and Hawkins continued on down the street, with Hawkins pointing out the town.
That first building there, just on the edge of town, is Rafferty's grocery store. Next comes Clinton's drug store. Over there on the other side of the street is a leather goods shop. It's run by Mark Worley. Next is McGill's feed and seed store, then Dupree's Emporium. Now, you mentioned that you wanted a hotel room. This is the Milner Hotel. I would tell you that it is the best hotel in town, which it is, but it's also the only hotel in town. And don't worry about the livery being right across the street. When the wind's right, you don't smell anything at all.
It might sound crazy, but I like the smell of horses. Something very comforting about them.
I know what you mean. I may not look like it now, being as I own a saloon, but I once was a member of the United States Cavalry. I rode with General George Crook when we were chasing Geronimo all over Hell's Half Acre. Oh, and you'll most likely be taking your supper here at Moe's. It's the
best in town?
Yes, and the only one in town.
Then it'll be a pleasure to have a drink at the best saloon in town. And I'm assuming it's also the only one in town?
You assume incorrectly, sir. On one thing you are right, though. The Texas Star is the best in town, but there are three other saloons. The Pig Palace, the Crooked Branch, and the Ace High down on Plantation Row.
Plantation Row?
Yes. They're actually down on First Street. Plantation Row is the locals' attempt at a little humor.
I take it they aren't stellar establishments.
Indeed, no. Seems someone is killed down on Plantation Row just about every other day. The biggest one, and probably the worst one, is the Pig Palace, owned by Jake Bramley. He waters his whiskey.
He does?
Well, the truth is, I don't know if he waters it or not, but that's what I tell everyone.
Don't worry, Mr. Hawkins. Your secret's safe with me.
And this, sir, is my place, the Texas Star.
Pushing through the front door of the Texas Star, Matt saw that it could have been any saloon in any town he had ever visited. Saloons like this, with the wide plank boards of the floor, the long polished bar with the brass footrail at the bottom, the piano at the back, the scattering of tables, and the saloon girls garish in their makeup, were part of Matt's existence. As was his custom, he made a quick perusal of the saloon before he moved on in. There were three men standing at the bar, six tables with two to four men at each of the tables. There was a card game underway at one of the tables, and Matt could see the faces of three of the men. The fourth man had his back to Matt so that he couldn't see his face, but there was something about him, about the way he was sitting, that caused Matt's look to linger. Huh. Braxton Barlow tied his horse off in front of the pawn shop that was on First Street next door to the Crooked Branch Saloon. When he walked into the shop carrying a gun in each hand, he was met by a man wielding a double-barreled shotgun.
Hold it right there, mister.
Wait, these guns here ain't loaded. I come to pawn them is all.
Then take them by the barrels and lay them on the counter.
Brax did as instructed, and when he did so, the shopkeeper put the shotgun down and dragged both the pistols across the counter toward him. Picking them up one at a time, he ascertained that both were empty, then put them back down.
I'll give you $5 apiece for them.
$5? Look here, I happen to know these pistols cost $25 when they was new.
They ain't new now.
But they still shoot as good as when they was new.
Where'd you get them?
What difference does it make where I got them? Point is, I got them, and now I'm trying to sell them to you.
How do I know you didn't steal them?
I didn't steal them.
$5. Take it or leave it.
All right. I'll take $5 apiece for them.
The pawnbroker opened a little box, took out two $5 bills, and passed them across the counter to Brax.
It's been nice doing business with you.
Disgusted over how little money he got for the two pistols, Brax stuck the bills down in his pocket.